Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am peachy keen.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and controversies, Dave Chappelle. That's it, just Dave Chappelle. I'm just going to say Dave Chappelle and we'll go. We got a lot of ground to cover here. His new special on Netflix, The Closer, has garnered much angst. Was it for saying that black people are cheap and make bad decisions? Or for saying he killed people with COVID to get this material down? Or for saying he liked being molested by a priest? Or for making light of the Asians getting beaten up in random attacks on city streets? Or for calling himself the Magic Johnson of coronavirus? Or for his lines about space Jews that downplayed the Holocaust? No, it was for none of those things. If you've been following the story, you know that it is in fact for his once again refusal to lay off of the transgender community, despite the fact that seemingly every cultural critic in America and every person who is involved in civil rights and everything, they're all yelling at him. They're saying, you got to stop making these jokes. You can't do it anymore. And he says, no, I will continue to joke about what I want to joke about. This refusal to acknowledge a protected class when it comes to humor has gotten him into hot water with Twitter, which, luckily, as Chappelle notes, in his special is not a real place. More interestingly, it has gotten Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos into hot water with his own employees, leading to talks of walkouts and internal criticism and external criticism. But most interestingly, this has led to Netflix data being leaked, which is an amazingly rare thing. This never happens, folks. They jealously guard their data to the extent where and they're famously transparent too, which is why this is very surprising. There's a lot of transparency within Netflix, but the data never leaks. One of the things he talks about in his memoirs actually is how he there's all this transparency, and he tells folks that if they leak it, they could actually go to jail because it could influence stock prices, and they all have stock, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all very interesting that this is coming out around this special. Okay, we'll talk about the data itself in a minute, but I just want to first note that Sarandos and other higher ups at Netflix have made the cardinal mistake of online outrage, and that is addressing it at all. Instead of Sarandos simply saying Chappelle pushes boundaries, and I'm a student of comedy, and I am not interested in deciding which boundaries are acceptable to push, he has addressed it over and over and over again. He keeps sticking his neck out there, and it's getting cut off over and over again. As my litany of jokes above, again, those were all actual jokes from the special, which I watched, all of those things he made light of. Chappelle is making a theory of comedy point in this special. He is arguing against the concept of punching down. Again, he makes light of everything from child sex abuse to hate crime victims to everything. There, nobody said boo about any of that, despite the fact that these are all explicitly examples of punching down. He is punching down on all of these people. The only thing anybody gets upset about is when he simply refuses to stop making the trans jokes, despite being told time and again that he has to do it. And I think that is what is driving people crazier more than anything else. Just his refusal to do the thing that he is being told to do. He is willfully misbehaving, and it is driving people very, very crazy. There's a lot to get into here. But one thing I just want to start with is Ted Sarandos saying that he does not believe that art, in this case, the Chappelle special, but just in general, can lead to direct harm, which I kind of agree with, but also kind of undermines much of Netflix's marketing about how they're making the world a better place. Right, Peter?
Well, I certainly think that it is a little bit complicated for Netflix to say this if they want to say that their work also can do social good. At the same time, I think it's essentially right. And I think the idea that the underlying idea here isn't just that art doesn't lead to direct real world harm. That's how he has phrased it. But the underlying idea is just a very simple one that is embedded in the First Amendment, in the sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me, you know, notion that all of us learned as children, which is that speech isn't violence. Speech can be offensive. It can be awful. It can be ugly. It can hurt feelings, but it doesn't hurt people directly. And so what he is saying is something that is contrary to a lot of what we have you know, heard over the last, let's say, decade or so amongst primarily left-leaning. I think you could also say there are some folks on the right who have made arguments that amount to this as well, but it's primarily a left-leaning cohort that has basically just decided to say that hateful speech is in some sense akin to violence and should be treated like violence. And I don't think that is correct, and I don't think that is the right way for speech businesses like Netflix. That's what they traffic in, is speech. I don't think that's the right way for them to think, and I don't think that's the right way for sort of policymakers and, you know, public intellectuals to think. I don't think that's the way that we should organize our society is around the notion that speech is violence.
Well, there is a horseshoe theory at work here, right? Where on the right, you have had people for years who have said that art can damage young people in particular, but can have active social harms in the forms of pornography or, you know, gangster rap or heavy metal music or whatever. And then on the left, you now get a lot of the same thing with regards to hate speech or punching down or whatever.
Yes, that is correct. I mean, there is no side of the political spectrum here that has been perfectly consistent. When I was growing up, it was definitely more the left that was defended the idea that speech wasn't itself harmful, because you had a lot of sort of conservative, or at least socially conservative, even if they were technically Democrats, like Tipper Gore, folks saying out that, oh, pop culture is causing harm to our children. You have the rap music, also video games, right? But I mean, it's striking to go back and read some of the hearings from the 1990s about rap music. And they were literally congressional hearings in which they would like talk about Marilyn Manson, and they would talk about some of the rappers at the time. And, you know, there Joe Lieberman, a Democrat, was, you know, out front on some of this stuff. But it was also a cause for the right as well. And it is somewhat striking to see the ways that this has sort of crossed ideologically. And, you know, I would say a little bit jokingly, but also kind of seriously, the only people who have ever been perfectly consistent on this are the libertarians. And libertarians have been right about this for a long time and are still right. And that's what I'm doing on this show.
That's fair. I think that's fair. And this is one area where I've always considered myself, like, this is like my most libertarian position, is that speech is good and we shouldn't try and shut people down.
It's not always good. So it's not always like good
I'm not saying everything
has ever said is good, right? But the solution to that,
yes,
the response to that is more speech and to argue with those people and to do the thing that we all do. And like, we argue with each other when we think we're wrong. Anyway,
Alyssa, what do you make of the fact that there is this internal revolt at Netflix, and how are they messing up in their handling of it? Because this is a series of failures.
Yeah, I want to go back to just for one second to the question of sort of speech is violence, because I actually think there is a way to thread the needle in talking about sort of the broad impact of culture versus the specific impact of individual incidences of speech. Because I think it's fairly obvious that media shapes our sense, media collectively, taken collectively, shapes our sense of what is normal, right? You have infinite examples of politicians, ordinary people talking about how art like Philadelphia or Will and Grace and the sort of accumulating compassionate images of gay people in media helped, you know, create the environment in which the civil rights movement for marriage equality was possible, that helped, you know, foster an environment in which people with HIV could be treated with greater compassion. In similar ways, I, as someone who has studied a lot of depictions of the police in pop culture, it's overwhelmingly obvious that pop culture has provided an extraordinary reputational subsidy to policing in America, whether that means, you know, giving the impression that certain forensic techniques are more accurate than they actually are, that the police close more cases than they actually do, et cetera. But it's very different to say that, you know, our media landscape as a whole shapes our sense of what is normal and how we act within those expectations or understandings of normalcy, and saying that if someone, you know, listens to too much Marilyn Manson and goes out and shoots up his school, that Marilyn Manson is responsible for that person's actions, that, you know, art that people get attached to is the equivalent of, you know, sort of clear incitement. And it's bizarre to me that Netflix can't sort of square that circle, because, and in general, it's bizarre to me that people can't talk with that kind of nuance, but then I'm constantly prepared to be disappointed. In terms of what's happening at Netflix broadly, I mean, I think it's probably inevitable that there was going to be a cultural collision of this sort at some point or other. And that is both, I think, probably the inevitable result of the kind of internal culture that, you know, you talked about in introducing the segment, Sunny. But I also think that there's some tension in Netflix's mission, right? They have signed these sort of big, high profile, you know, what I'd almost call social impact deals. And they've doled out an enormous amount of money to the Obamas, to Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, to sort of make socially conscious content, and have presented that as part of their mission. At the same time, it has, I think, become sort of overwhelmingly clear that a lot of what Netflix produces is, you know, commercial dreck. And that, you know, Squid Game is kind of their first, you know, almost substantial arty hit in a while. They've had deals with, Shonda Rhimes that have been sort of slow to come to fruition, with Ryan Murphy that haven't really worked out. They've not had the equivalent of, say, Orange is the New Black in a long time. They're relying a lot more heavily on cheaper to produce reality stuff. And, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, I believe that Ted Sarandos is a student of comedy, that he loves Dave Chappelle, that he believes he's an important voice. But, you know, Netflix needs to grow its subscriber base constantly to keep up its level of spending on content. It is sort of topping out in the United States, as the sort of early post-pandemic numbers suggest. And there is no world in which Netflix is going to lay down a marker and say, you know, not only will we sort of give up on Dave Chappelle because he has this, you know, sort of commitment to deliberate provocation, but we're probably not going to lay down markers on content in general, because we actually need to include the broadest possible range of, you know, viewpoints and attempts to appeal to possible subscribers. We can't afford to be a subscription service for liberals. That's right. Not a thing that they're going to do. And, you know, they can't afford to just, like, they can't be HBO, right? Like, they can't actually be boutique and high end and subscribe with, you know, survive with 8 million subscribers or 10 million subscribers. If Netflix is going to keep going and win this arms race, it needs to get as many people on the planet subscribing as possible. And, you know, Netflix does not operate in China, which is kind of the big exception to, you know, Hollywood. But for example, in order to stay operational in Saudi Arabia, you know, censored Hasan Minhaj. And Netflix, you know, you can give Meghan Markle as much money as you want, but ultimately Netflix needs to appeal to a lot of people. And that's going to mean producing stuff that not only is not to a lot of subscribers' tastes, but that offends some people or annoys some people.
Well, I mean, we saw a fight over this last year with the Cuties, or maybe was that even earlier this year? I can't even remember. But the fight over Cuties. Last year. Right, which, you know, people on the right said, oh, this is horrible child pornography. How can you publish this sort of thing? And other people pushed back and said, no, look, this is an anti-child exploitation work. You know, you have to actually watch the thing to put up with it. But I mean, I guess what I find really interesting about this is the internal culture at Netflix demanding that the site and the product be more censorious than it can be to survive, really. I mean, I just don't see how they square that circle internally without simply ignoring or frankly starting to fire people who publicly come out and denounce the product. I mean, I honestly don't know how they do it.
One person, I believe, has already been fired.
Well, for leaking the internal data,
right?
Though.
But this is the difference: is that this person was fired for leaking internal data, not for being public about criticizing Netflix. And that's an interesting distinction there, is that they've said they seem to be adopting, at least for the moment, and Lord knows this could change even by the time this podcast goes up, but they seem to be adopting at this moment a "you're allowed to criticize us" line, but you're not allowed to leak proprietary company information to the media. And that actually doesn't seem like a completely crazy distinction to me.
Well, I think that's the smartest thing to do here. When I say I don't know what they're going to do without firing people, I don't really mean that, because I think firing people just makes it worse. Actually, if you start firing everybody who criticizes you, then you turn a small problem into a big problem. The smart thing to do is simply to ignore it. Just to say, we published this thing. If you don't like it, that's fine. You're not going to like everything that we make, and you can't. You simply are going to have to live with it. I mean,
Spotify has had this exact same problem basically with Joe Rogan. It is it is affecting a lot of companies that host media personalities, right? And there is clearly a market for media personalities, of whether they're comedians, whether they're talk show hosts, whether they are just writers who don't toe the line that, like, some people within large tech companies like Netflix and Spotify and Apple would like them to toe. And so those companies are going to have to decide how much it's what, you know, who is more important for them to retain, the people who are drawing very large audiences, or the however many staffers it is. And it's not, you know, it's not clear to me whether a huge percentage of the Netflix staff really finds Chappelle over the line, or whether it's a small percentage. I genuinely don't know. And it's a different issue if, like, depending on whether it's, you know, whether it's a small faction or whether it's, like, really most Netflix people who work for Netflix think this was a terrible idea and the boss is out on his, you know, out on a limb here.
And it'll be interesting to see. There is a walkout scheduled for the 20th. How many people participate? Yeah. Because there's a sort of in-between space between people who, you know, a small faction who's very invested in this, a large faction that's not, but perhaps there's some percentage of that who feel obligated to show solidarity or, you know, sort of social conformity with the people for whom this is not acceptable. And it's an interesting debate to watch as someone who works in the opinion section of a major newspaper, and in fact sort of one of the last places where a sort of broad ideological spectrum is represented in the workforce. Because, you know, one of the things I really enjoy about working for the Post is, you know, the sort of internal arguments and discussions about issues, and the fact that, you know, there is a culture of dissent, sometimes fairly sharp dissent, that goes up and down the chain, but there's a larger commitment to the project, right? There's not a sense that we're going to achieve ideological purity or narrowness. We argue about where the margins are, but I think that kind of culture is, you know, it's at this point in American public life, it's kind of weird. And it does not surprise me that content companies are sort of coming up against the limits of fostering a culture of dissent and a sort of broad sense of what's acceptable, when that's just not something that a lot of workers have practice at.
It's also just notable that Chappelle, like Joe Rogan, is not a conservative, right? He's not like a right-wing guy by any means. And in fact, spends a bunch of this special just making jokes at the expense of poor white people in Ohio and North Carolina, of middle American Trump voters. Yeah. And, like, it's quite brutal in his mocking of them as well. And it's this doesn't just sort of play in a kind of very traditional right-left as a traditional right-left argument. It is something more complex than that, and in fact reflects the fact that not everyone actually just sort of fits into, like, oh, this person is a Democratic progressive liberal and this person is a hardcore Trump supporting conservative. There are actually a bunch of people whose politics are, like, they're not even moderates either. They're somewhere in between, and they're scrambled and strange, because that's how people are.
This is, I think, the biggest actual point from Chappelle's special is that it is not the concept of punching down is false. true equality in Chappelle's mind, and I think this is right, is the ability to make fun of everybody all the time and treat everybody as equals. I mean, he explicitly talks about this in the special, that like I felt comfortable joking with my transgender friend Daphne because we all were making fun of everybody all the time. Like that like it's a very interesting. You should watch the special. You should not just listen to all of the outrage. You should actually watch it for yourself, because I mean, again, there's a very interesting moment where he does a bit on the bathroom laws in North Carolina that I think is very interesting, because he's clearly opposed to these laws. He thinks they're dumb and terrible. And nobody is talking about how the actual policy things that he talks about in this line up very much like on the nose with the left and the civil rights lobby and how they think about this. Anyway, we're running long on this. What do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Dave Chappelle exists? Peter.
It's a listen, apparently a controversy.
Humanity is controversial. Life on the planet is controversial. Yet what's going on in Netflix and their attempt to sort out their internal culture is obviously a controversy.
Yeah. It's a controversy. And it's an interesting one. And I hope it doesn't get boiled down to very rote name calling, as it kind of appears to be headed. But we'll see. If you enjoy the show, and who does not enjoy the show, make sure to head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where we're going to be talking about one of my favorite directors, Ridley Scott, and which of his movies we like best and for what reasons. Speaking of Ridley Scott, on to the main event. The Last Duel. One elevator pitch for The Last Duel is something like this. It's a medieval Me Too story. And while it is undoubtedly that, the eponymous combat being undertaken to resolve a claim of rape leveled by Marguerite, played by Jodie Comer, against Jacques Legris, played by Adam Driver, it is in fact much more than that. One thing it is very funny, weirdly. Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, who also star in the movie, co-wrote the film alongside Nicole Holofcener. Affleck plays a noble just below the king. He's not the king. He's like a duke or something. I don't know how French nobility works. And he does so with a sort of decadent relish. He's fancy. He's a fancy lad.
He does so
with a sort of decadent relish that underscores the absurdity of his privilege. Damon, meanwhile, plays Jean de Carrouge, husband of Marguerite, and the wronged party here, at least as far as French law is concerned. Affleck spends much of the film sneering at Damon, annoyed by his stodginess and his low manners and his illiteracy. Affleck's Duke has more fun with Driver,
Count, Viscount, whatever.
Frenchy McFrenchy has more fun with Driver, sharing his orgy bed with the squire as he sometimes does. The whole film is, in a way, driven by de Carrouge's effort to gain money and respect. He loses a parcel of land he was believed to be owed as part of Marguerite's dowry to Legris. He is passed over by Affleck's d'Alençon for, French is the worst. I am terrible with it. For a captaincy in favor of Legris. And Carrouge is, his social impotence really is the issue here. It's the cause of much of the humor of the film, as well as much of the drama, and the trailers have kind of belied all of this. Also funny in a dark way is the manner with which we watch the two genders react to the events in question. While Marguerite's name is being dragged through the mud, the women all wince and look away, while the men are practically licking their lips at the scandal of it all. It's structured in kind of a Rashomon-style way that gives us the same events from three different perspectives, that of de Carrouge, then Legris, and then Marguerite, who gets a little extra caption that says, "The truth. This is the truth. This is the way it is." And it's interesting to see the little differences between the three recountings. Again, one small one here. When the sexual assault at the heart of the film begins, Legris remembers her taking off her shoes before running up the steps. But in Marguerite's retelling, the camera focuses on her feet again, and we see them like falling off. They just fall off as she flees up the steps in terror. It's a small difference again, but it's one that shades how each party in this event understands what actually took place. The whole thing builds to a genuinely rousing and emphatic final fight, which is really just a tremendous set piece. I have to say, I kind of love this movie. Alyssa, did it work from your point of view?
It really did. And I was sort of surprised by how deeply this has stuck with me. You know, it was a movie I was interested to see. And liked while I was watching it and kind of have not been able to stop thinking about. And part of what has been really powerful about it to me is that it takes on this question of, you know, in contemporary discourse about sex, there is this sort of there's this kind of disbelief about the idea that someone might not know the difference between sex and rape. And yet, you know, a lot of these Me Too conversations have illustrated that there is not actually a commonly accepted definition and broad understanding of what sexual assault means, right? You have incidents like the essay a young woman wrote about a date with Aziz Ansari that she felt like sort of got caught up in a power differential. You have California's new law saying that removing a condom from, during sex without your partner's consent, a practice known as stealthing, is a form of sexual battery. And what is really interesting about the way The Last Duel handles this question is that it not only... So the depictions of Legree's sexual assault of Marguerite, what's interesting about the two depictions of them is not how different they are, but how similar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought the detail you mentioned was really nice. You know, there's some tonal differences in the way Marguerite hears herself saying no. You know, she sort of sees herself afterwards with, you know, like tears and mucus sticking to the bedspread as, you know, after she gets up. You know, there are all these sort of tiny questions of degree, but what the movie does in the third of it that's in Legree's perspective is it explores how he is initiated into this elite sexual culture that involves sort of double talk, that involves, sort of violent form of play as a form of seduction. There is this moment where he, you know, in talking to his lawyer, he says, you know, I mean, she's a lady. She made the usual protests. You understand how he has become inculcated in a definition of sex where, you know, consent is inherently blurred, where violence is sort of and force are kind of inherently part of the way sex is carried out. And, you know, I think the movie leaves space for the idea that Legree is kind of using this as cover, but it also leaves open the possibility that he genuinely believes that this is sex and this is how consent works. And so it suggests that in the 635 years since this duel actually took place, we have not settled some of these questions in a way that we, you know, kind of think would be part of our progress towards modernity. I think it's easy to look at this movie and say, oh, you know, this is kind of shoehorning this into the Me Too debate. But I actually went back and read the nonfiction book that it's based on. These parallels, you know, they're really clear. This is not, you know, Affleck and Damon and Nicole Holofcener, who wrote the third of the movie from Marguerite's perspective, just sort of shoehorning in a bunch of modern ideas about sex and consent. You know, these debates have been ongoing and unsettled for, you know, 6.5 centuries. And that is kind of unsettling and interesting in a way that, you know, to a certain extent, we haven't solved all of these questions about, you know, what sex and good sex looks like and how consent works because they're hard. And I found it just sort of interestingly, you know, kind of ideologically sly to a certain extent, right? Mm-hmm. That it, you know, it's theoretically a medieval Me Too movie, but it also undercuts our sense of progress and specifically is very condemnatory of an elite sexual culture that is, you know, kind of decadent and ugly and geared towards making sure men get and can take what they want within a permissive framework that in this sort of one case gets constricted, but yeah, not in most.
Yeah. Peter, what did you make of this?
I really liked this movie. And like Alyssa, I've thought about it quite a bit since watching it. In fact, I think I like the movie even more the more, like, having thought about it, right? It's one of these movies that has grown in my estimation over time because it sort of has revealed itself in its various layers to me. And so, you know, like Alyssa said, this is a movie about perspective, but it's also a movie, you know, and Alyssa, you got into this to some extent. It's a movie about how culture shapes perspective. And obviously, the subject, the primary thing that it is about is rape and sex, and right? And so the question that the movie raises without quite actually stating is whether or not Legree understood what he was doing as rape. And it leaves we of course understand it as rape. The movie leaves no question for the viewers. But what it does is it says maybe he didn't really fully know or didn't allow himself to know, because what he was doing was playing out a cultural script, one that was familiar to him both explicitly from the games that he played in Ben Affleck's Count's orgy bedroom, but also one that was given to him by other men in power at the time. And so there's this bit that I think is really important to understanding the movie. Before we get to the duel itself, we're in a courtroom with the king and they're arguing their cases, right? It's the two men arguing against each other. And one, somebody from, I don't know, the jury or some official person explains, well, you know, she conceived a child, became pregnant out of this, and according to their theories at the time, this is what they're saying, to be clear, you cannot conceive a child if you don't feel pleasure. And if you feel pleasure during a sexual encounter, well, then by definition, it can't be rape. And he says, in a line that is just totally on the nose in some ways, he said that this court official just says, that's just science. Now, we could argue, and people did, in fact, in my Twitter feed, argue about whether the idea of science as we think about it now is a modern one that they would have understood at all. But that line is there for a reason, because what it's telling us is that this movie is, yes, of course it's about sex and rape and consent and all of those things. And of course it's about perspective, but it's also just about elite systems of power and how elites basically sort of they use the law, they use the crown, they use the religion, and they use the cover of science to justify the things that they want to do that end up abusing and sort of taking power over other people who don't have it. And so I think this movie is just super interesting in that it is like there's a very conventional left-leaning, right, like, you know, sort of like this was rape. They didn't even understand it, how barbaric they were. That reading is correct. That reading, I'm not saying that reading is wrong, but there's another one sort of lurking beneath the surface that's like, actually, all of these systems of control and power that maybe we still have today that say things like, that's just science and this is how science works. That's just people using the cover of institutional authority to justify the stuff they already want to do.
Can we discuss Ben Affleck's performance in this for a minute? Because I have to say, I have not been as surprised by a performance in recent. I cannot remember the last time I was this surprised by a performance specifically in recent years. Let me put it that way. Because in the trailer, he gets one line and he has this ridiculous accent, and I'm like, they're clearly hiding something with Ben Affleck here, and they were, but not the thing I thought they were hiding. The way he is portrayed in this film, the way he plays the Count is almost like it's from another movie. But that is also kind of the point of his role here, is that he exists on a different plane of accountability and a different plane of you know, behavior than everybody else in this film. And he's still below the king. We don't see the king, but he is essentially acting with the king's power,
sort of,
more or less.
Yeah, he's an extension of the king.
And I want to specifically get what you guys make of this performance. And if we are taking this as a kind of medieval Me Too, what would his position be in the world of Hollywood? Is he like a studio head? What is he? Is he like a high powered producer?
There has been some suggestion that Affleck and Damon participated in this at least in part out of guilt over their working with Harvey Weinstein. And so I don't want to say that's what he is, But that doesn't seem completely insane to suggest, to think that there is some some sort of relationship there. Though I also just don't know, and you know, that's very, it's totally speculative.
Yeah, I'm sort of hesitant to come up with a comparison there because, you know, it's so inexact, and the sort of governmental power that he wields, especially given the state of France at the time. I mean, Charles came to power extremely young. The France was essentially ruled by his uncles, and he eventually went completely insane and became convinced that he was made of glass, but that's totally separate. But
who
I think
us?
That he, you know, he embodies this idea that there are people who are so sort of sophisticated and powerful that they are exempt from the ordinary moral rules. And, you know, Peter, one thing you and I talked about after seeing this movie is that there's a really interesting sort of urban-rural clash here, right? I mean, there's the sort of deliberate mocking of Dick Rouge, who can't read, can't write. There's also a very interesting scene where Legree is at a dinner that the Count is throwing and is reading from The Romance of the Rose in the original Latin. And that's a text that was, you know, sort of an elite favorite at the time, but also was controversial. I mean, writers like Christine de Pizan condemned it for sort of misogyny and a violent view of sexuality. And there is definitely this sense in the movie that, you know, Pierre is a person, you know, from whom a sort of sexual culture and a theory of power flow, and who views himself as operating just on a different scale, not only in questions of, you know, kind of in indoctrinating Legree in what sex means, but in terms of his ability and authority to judge other people. You know, one of the things we learn that is that Legree has gained favor with the Count by kind of setting his affairs in order and, you know, actually collecting his tax revenues, which is how the Count gets his hands on the land that de Carouge thinks that he's entitled to. And, you know, I'm sort of going on here a little bit, but
he's a high competence, technically adept, educated. He is a tech worker, right?
Except like, that he's kind of not, right? Because we actually learn that he's terrible at administering. He's like a terrible administrator. He actually, I mean, the interesting parallel here is actually, I don't know if the two of you have read Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell trilogy, but, you know, Pierre is sort of like the equivalent of Henry VIII. You know, he is this person whose kind of personal whims and tastes have enormous influence. And then Legree is his Thomas Cromwell figure, the person who comes in and is the sort of ruthlessly efficient administrator who,
he's effectively like, you know, a coder or like a, you know, a kind of producer working within the studio system who like always delivers the movie, that sort of thing. The performance that Ben Affleck's reminded me of most was of, if you guys have seen True Romance, and you remember in the third act of the movie, Christian Slater ends up trying to sell a huge bag of, I think it's coke or some sort of drugs, to a movie producer played by Saul Rubinek. And he has sort of rented out this hotel room, and he's both powerful and sleazy at the same time, and just sort of used to having everything work towards, you know, towards his whims and be delivered to him when he, you know, snaps his fingers. And I do think there is, without wanting to say that it's definitely based on some specific person or anything like that, there is a sense of kind of Hollywood-like power in that he is somebody who can make things happen, but he mostly spends time pleasuring himself, enjoying being fancy, and then hires somebody else who's the high competence person to do it.
Yeah, I mean, he's a figure of decadence. And the ways in which, you know, people who see themselves as operating on a different plane, I think, are very easily prone to falling into decadence and self-indulgence and decay, and continue to exert those values through the cultural norms that they set, even as those behaviors should undermine their claim to being an elite.
Yeah. All right, so what do we think of The Last Duel? Thumbs up or thumbs down? Alyssa?
Thumbs up.
Peter?
Thumbs up. It's a good Ridley Scott movie in the spirit of so many good Ridley Scott movies.
We'll talk more about that in a bit. Thumbs up for me as well. Very good movie. I have to say, again, I was very surprised by this movie. Do not let the advertisements, which are weirdly dour and dire, dissuade you from going to see this. It's a far more interesting film than the ads have let on. We didn't even talk about the action in this scene.
The horse fighting is great.
The duel at the end calls to mind the best of Ridley Scott's action work from Gladiator or Black Hawk Down. I mean, it just is. It's very, very well done. So go see it. It's exciting. It'll make you think. Everyone wants to think. That is it for today's show. A programming note. Our lovely host, Alyssa, is going on maternity leave starting next week. Don't worry. The show will go on. We've lined up a guest host who will be filling in for the next 14 days. That's as much maternity leave as you get, Alyssa. I'm sorry. That's it. Just, you know, 2 weeks. She'll be back. She'll be back when she's ready to come back. A couple months. We'll see her again. But we've got Chris Orr coming up, who Alyssa, Peter, and I know well from DC area screenings, and who you might know from The Atlantic and Forbes. Anyway, Alyssa, we will miss you. We will see you again soon. Do you want to say anything to the people before you go?
Tell them anything. This podcast is the highlight of my week. I love talking to these guys and to all our really wonderful listeners. And I am sorry I'm not going to get to talk about Dune and The French Dispatch with you because they're both real great. But I will be back as...
How dare you?
Spoilers.
I will be back as soon as it feels right to be back. And I am just really, really excited that movies are now a part of our lives again. And I can't wait to talk about them with my friends, who include all of you.
Yay. All right. That's enough sappiness. If you love this week's show, make sure to check out our members only bonus feed on Ridley Scott's body of work. It's going to be Alyssa's last episode. So go sign up for a membership if you haven't done that already. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.